Hello, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined as ever by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to welcome back Eric Mathis, who is the author of Python Crash Course, works a lot with Django deployment, and we're going to talk all about deployment this episode. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
So, deployment. Multiple ways we can get into this. You have recently released an open source package, Django Simple Deploy. So we want to talk a lot about that. We want to talk about deployment in general, book-driven development, and just catch up on, I guess, how you've been too the last 2 years, I think, since we spoke. So
yeah, it's been a while.
Catch us up on what you've been doing since, because you were teaching, I think, still teaching full-time when we spoke, and you've stopped doing that. So you've had time to fill with other things.
Yeah, I have had my time filled.
Like COVID.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. To briefly catch up, 2019, I left the classroom because it turns out writing a popular book and teaching means two jobs. So I basically worked two jobs for 5 years and it was getting a little overwhelming. So I left the classroom in 2019 and then took that fall semester off to just decompress and make a long list of projects I wanted to do, and then 2020 came about. So I'm here to talk about Django Simple Deploy and deployment in general, and that really is one of these projects that's been kind of lingering in my mind for years, and I'm finally finding time again to dig into these kinds of projects.
Yeah, well, we've spoken about this in the context of just how do we make it simple for readers of our books, because you have a great section in your book, and I certainly looked at that when I was doing my books, and we've had back and forth on, is there something we're missing here? Because Heroku is great, but doesn't quite get you where we want to be. So I think we're going to talk about that, right? Like our ideal wish list for deployment.
But, right.
And maybe we could tee up, and maybe Carlton, to you, since you're working on...
Okay, so you mentioned Heroku, so I kind of think Heroku is awesome if you fit its use case. But the way I kind of came to think of it after the years was a kind of deployment cul-de-sac, in that you drive in, it's all very nice and houses are pretty, but you get to the end and you realize that, oh, actually, I've got to drive all the way back out to carry on to the next section. There's no through road from that kind of platform. So that's kind of, you know, my metaphor for why not the Heroku stories. How does that sound to you, Eric, if I just throw that up in the air and you can smack it over the bleachers?
Oh, I have not heard that metaphor before. I think it's brilliant. I like the cul-de-sac, but I have been...
Yeah, no, it's a nice cul-de-sac, but the second right. you don't quite fit the use case, it's like, oh no, I've got to spin up this extra service and this extra dyno and this extra... And it becomes anything but simple and quite limiting very quickly once you reach... that point.
Right. And so the subject of deployment just brings us into the weeds right away. I have been curious. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast over the years. And listening to a podcast for years, you start to get the patterns. And so I don't know if you guys know this, but I've noticed that whenever the word deployment comes up, there's audible groans and moans. And I groan and moan in the kitchen and laugh, and I'm sure it happens all over the place. So I was going to ask you guys, what's your thoughts on why? So deployment is critical for a framework like Django and any web framework. So if there's a piece, deployment, that's involved in almost every project, why is it that we groan and moan every time the word comes up? I'm curious to hear from you guys, and I'll share why I laugh when I'm listening.
Okay, I'll start.
You're
making bunny ears at me. I was like, peace sign.
Well, no, I've got two points I'll say, but you go first, Will, and then I'll say mine.
Okay. So I thought a lot about this. Both, you know, at a company deployment, you know, most of the engineers at a company at scale are focused on infrastructure. Basically, it's not the CRUD part; it's the making it scale, making it fast. And then how do you teach that to beginners? I think one of the hard things for Django is that, you know, Django is not responsible per se for deployment, yet because we use it, we think, oh, it should just have that too. And, you know, Heroku is really good. It's designed for Rails. So Rails, there's a one-click solution. You know, there's several steps to make Heroku work for Django. It's not that complicated, but it's complicated enough that you can mess it up. So I think part of it is that Heroku is not a Django-first solution. It's one click for Rails by design. I think the bigger thing, though, is that local to production is hard. And you have really nice guardrails, and it's a nice clean garden doing Django locally. You got SQLite. You don't have to worry about security. Everything defaults to it. But then when it's production, it's a choose-your-own-adventure, and you're just waiting to make a mistake. So there's performance problems. There's security problems. There's also just lots of different ideas about how you deploy it, plus production database, right? So it's how do I do that? You know, nowadays you can do a hosted production database, which really simplifies it, but you still probably want something working locally. So does that mean Heroku? Does that mean spinning up your own thing? So I think it's that huge leap from the knowns of Django local dev, which is really nice and clean, to, you know, you ask the experts, they all tell you something different about how to deploy. So to me, that's, I think, the crux of it. So it's partly Django, but I think it's more the local to production thing. And then Heroku, as much as I like it, again, could be more optimized for Django. But Carlton, you go. You've got...
Yeah, well, you basically hit my points. I think that I'd say there's so many options. Like, one reason that there isn't a Django solution is that we can't agree. So quite regularly, it comes up to the Django developers mailing list, something like, oh, can we include a solution for M variables, reading M variables into your setting files? Because that's better than hard coding, you know. But as soon as that comes in, it's like, hang on, but, you know, M vars aren't actually, you know, best practice necessarily. Look at the log4j thingy bob vulnerability where they were reading environment variables. You know, there are serious objections to using environment variables at all. And so then it gets into this massive debate, and it's like, no, this isn't something we can have inside Django, but look, there's Django Environs that lives as a perfectly good third-party package. Go and use that. And, you know, it would be the same for deployment. You know, there's just no consensus at all about how you should get your web app online, and it so much depends. It depends. There you are. We've done it. We're 7 minutes in.
Bingo.
It so much depends on what your circumstance is, that there is no Django battery included. This is the thing that should live in the core framework solution that fits the 85% case. And then the other bit was, so there's just so many moving parts. You go do the Django tutorial, you learn to build your web application, and then it's like you go, how do I get it online? And you've got literally like another week full time's work just to get it provisioned. And, you know, the first time you do it, you've got to learn about Bash, you've got to learn about MVARs, you've got to learn about databases, you've got to learn about rsync, you've got to learn about SSH keys, you've got to learn, you know, just all of it is just massive. So there you are. Too many options, too many moving parts. They're my one and two.
I find too that because you set it up, your deployments process, the pipeline, and then you don't really look at it again. So in doing the books, I'm curious if you have this, Eric. I sort of do everything from scratch, and I forget half the things or something's changed. Whereas in a company setting, if you're a Django expert, you have it set up and you're good to go. Or my existing projects, you know, I have it configured, but when I have to do it from scratch, it's just so many steps and things change. So that's challenging. Like I can still never remember all the steps, even for Heroku, for a production database. You know, I mean, just tossing it up, I got that memorized, but all the little steps, even I'm just like, you know, I have to refer to my own books as a reference.
Yeah. We write books to document our own learning, right?
No, but these are checklists, you know, like a pilot flying a plane. I'm robbing Daniele Prothida's take here, but a pilot flying a plane uses a checklist. Why? Because it's a high stress thing, and you'll forget if you don't have a checklist. It's okay to look it up. It's okay to have a checklist. That's allowed.
But before you start, Eric, my dream, because you also asked this in the notes, like what would be the ideal? I would want something like, so there's Netlify bought this company Drop, where you can drag and drop a static site. Just like physically drag it or push it, and they'll just deploy it. So it's very opinionated. But if there was something for Django where you could just drag and drop it in, it has a hosted database, it has, you know, some degree of caching by default, and then it's kind of had a list of buttons where you could up the ante on security and performance, which ups the complexity. But there was some baseline of like, this won't, you know, debug is off, you know, you're not totally bad. It's not performant, but you're not going to get hacked right away. And you could just go from there. That would be ideal to me, but I don't think that is a great business case because it's beginners who don't have much money. But I think it's possible to do a drag and drop, because Carlton, I don't think Button is not designed for that. You're a more advanced case.
No. So the button use case is provision a setup on EC2, just a basic setup on EC2 with the bits in place. Pull your project from GitHub, make sure that's and set up all of that and get that running. So it's provision, deploy, and then backup, monitor, redeploy. That would be the sort of the picture that you're looking at there.
Okay, Eric, you go for half an hour now.
All right. One of the things I was thinking about anticipating this conversation was, what was my first deployment? And it was probably back in 2010, 2012-ish. I think it was Django 1.4 or 1.5. And I had a problem at school where we were keeping track of the learning standards that we were using for our students. This is a small high school. And I looked at the system we were developing, and we were doing some really innovative work. And I realized that all of our work, all of it, was in Word documents. And so we had a conversation in our staff and had figured out a way to move forward. And it involved changing the structure of what we'd been building. And I realized we could not do it. We literally could not take that step forward because everything was in static documents. And I realized really quickly that we needed a database. I don't think there's a real generally user-friendly database. Like, people used to have access, and I don't hear much about that anymore. And I realized quickly that if you want a database now, a lot of it is about building a web app, a front end for a web app can be oftentimes viewed as a front end for a database. So I did some research, learned about Django, built a little project that did exactly what we needed. Wow, cool, it works on my machine. All right, I can probably get this ready for other people on my staff to use. Like, oh no. Oh gosh, deployment. And this is before Heroku. And so my solution was to configure a laptop to run with the lid closed. And I got it running on Run Server and dumped it into a closet, and we all had access to it.
And that was on the local network, yeah?
It was.
And so I think, perfect.
Yeah, and so
very safe.
Yeah, I used a Run Server in small production. So I think of when I think of this specifically for people who are new to Django or new to deployment, I think of deployment as a cliff. And so if you think of people who are just learning Django, it's a little intimidating for a lot of people to get into because there's so many moving parts. But they face that difficulty. They choose a learning resource, whether it's a tutorial or a book or whatnot. They build a project, maybe they modify a little bit and see like, oh, my idea works. And it's all working on your local system. And to really get something out of a web app, you need to share it with other people, for most people. And so you say, okay, it's going to continue on the same momentum that I've had in building a web app. And then, like Carlton, I think, said, like, or one of you just said, then you realize, like, oh, it's another week of learning. After that week of learning, I'm still going to have this thing that I worry about falling apart somehow. And so, what do we do about that cliff? I just finished listening to your conversation with Adam, where he talks about book-driven development. And I think it's a good phrase. I certainly have experienced that. And so a lot of my motivation for thinking about this has come from helping readers of Python Crash Course deploy the learning log project that we build in the book. That's the most fragile part of the book because I basically walk people through configuring a project for initial deployment to Heroku. And at that point, my book is really just a recasting of Heroku's documentation for how to do your initial deployment. And I've been thinking about, like, okay, why have I been so dissatisfied with that part of the book? And I realized, just thinking about this last night, that a lot of what I've written is teaching people concepts, teaching people how to think about code, how to think about solving problems with code. When you get to that part of the book, is really not teaching about concepts. It's really a set of instructions. Do this, then do this, then do this, then do this. And I think as grateful as I am to Heroku for what they have offered, I think it's absolutely fantastic. If Heroku was available back when I was doing that education project, I probably would have used it and been very happy with it. And so Heroku has moved the space forward, but they're still at a space where like those initial steps could all be automated. So I've been wrestling in my mind for years about how to automate that for people.
Sounds like you should be the Django evangelist for Heroku.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we can kind of build this where all this new work has come from. About a year ago, I ended up learning about the Heroku build pack a little bit more. And I wrote a custom Heroku build pack that lets you set a configuration variable, like automate all. And if that variable is set, then Heroku would generate a proc file for you, would pull in white noise for static files. It would basically inspect your project and do all of the automatable steps that could be made. As well as you mentioned, it's basically an opinionated initial deployment of Heroku.
But that sounds perfect, right?
But that didn't feel good.
Because 90%...
But that didn't feel good because it... Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, but that sounds great because 90% of projects are just exactly the same, especially for that first deployment.
Right. It did not feel good, though, because it really did feel like doing Heroku's work for them. And Daniel Greenfeld, PyDanny, pointed that out when I shared that on Twitter. And I appreciate him and I appreciate people like him calling out when open source work leans too far into the world of doing a company's work for them. I was okay with it because for me, it was an exploration of what could be done, but it did not leave a good feeling behind for me.
You've got thoughts on this as well, Will, no? Like,
yeah, you're triggering. Yeah. I mean, I've stripped out increasingly external things from my books just because of I felt that I was doing their work for them, and they change constantly, and then people come to me and say, why doesn't, you know, this other service work? I've wondered, why don't they invest in someone to do this? You know, Stripe, for example. You know, Stripe's a great company. I had the official Django Stripe tutorial for a long time, and I had a team of I think it was a half dozen Stripe employees kind of jumping on my back to update it for this and that. I was like calculating, okay, six of you, the time it takes, like, that's so much money. Like, you just do it. You know, like, why are you outsourcing this? Like, why don't you just take half dozen popular frameworks and do it? And I still don't have a good answer for why they do that. Don't just like dedicate an engineer to, you know, once a month look at it, other than maybe they feel, I don't know, they don't want ownership over it. I don't know. It's a little mystifying to me, but I've also just stripped out as much as I can just for that reason, that it feels like I'm doing their work for them. And I don't, you know, presumably they're making enough money. So I don't know what the issue is. I've asked a lot of developer advocates. I wonder, I think they're more focused on like new features, whereas sometimes, you know, specific to Django, it's not like the top framework they're thinking of for whatever reason. So that's just a word jumble. I don't know. It's a frustration for me. I don't quite understand why a $1 billion-plus company can't devote a little bit of time to just having a tutorial, not just docs, for the top, you know, three or four frameworks that use it.
Well, I think I have that answer for Heroku, or a fair understanding of that answer. And this is a little plug for going to conferences when it's appropriate to do so. I've gotten to meet, I think, all of the people who've been responsible for Django on Heroku over the years. Kenneth Wrights, back in probably 2013, 2015-ish. Casey Feist, I think, was for a while. Ed Morley, I think, is the current Heroku person responsible for Django. I haven't met him in person, but I've had conversations with him online. All these people are nice. All these people get the core issue, but I think they're tasked with so many other things that this never rises to priority. And so I think it's that growth issue. So Heroku was founded to make initial deployments easier. They solved that problem to a large degree, they got bigger and then their problems became bigger. And so once you get to a certain size, small issues tend to disappear, and unless somebody is there long enough to continually say, okay, this has been hanging out for a while, we need to prioritize that. It doesn't excuse it, but I think it does explain it, and not just Heroku, but a lot of organizations.
It's kind of the point you made, Will, about there not being a business case for this kind of niche, because, well, you know, people getting their first Django app online aren't necessarily the biggest spenders.
Yeah, and I think they don't have a way to track it, you know, because you would think that opening the funnel would be a good idea, and I'm sure it is, but if they can't track it, they can't reward it. I think also Jacob Kaplan-Moss was at Heroku back in the day, and I know around tooling, I mean, Kenneth did a lot. Like he had, I forget the name of it, he had his Django deployment package, which is still referenced in the docs, though it hasn't been updated in 5 years. You know, he really was making some efforts on that front, but yeah, it's still referenced, it's dead, and it's still there. And but yeah, I don't doubt it's what you said. It's, you know, they're hit with so many other things, and if there isn't a top level business case for it, it's...
Well, see, Carlton, but I'm going to say one more thing on this. It's understandable why these kinds of things drop in priority, but it's also a little risky, because if the other platform solves this problem, it becomes much easier for everybody else to jump onto. That's where business
disruption,
starts to...
a new upstart comes up from the bottom, makes it simpler.
Yep. So it's an understandable business decision, but it's also a risky one.
So, okay, cool. You phrased it slightly strangely, Eric, in that you said something like, I found it uncomfortable that I was doing Heroku's work. And the way you use the past tense slightly there, it sounds as if you've done something else that moves past that.
Yes. All right. Yeah. So ruminating on this over the years, I realized that what didn't feel good about that Heroku build pack solution was that it's grounded in the Heroku world. And so I realized there's multiple ways to modify a project. So the build pack solution was to take your project, and as it heads toward the Heroku platform, on Heroku's end, modify the project for their deployment. And I realized you can modify on your own end. So I came to the solution of writing a management command that you run this command once, and it modifies the project as needed for the platform. And then you can push your project pre-configured for that platform. So I turned it into a package, and you can pip install it. Basically, you can take a simple Django project. If it works locally on your system, you do three steps. Pip install Django simple deploy, add simple deploy to install apps, and then you can run the command python manage.py simple deploy --- automate all, and it pushes your project to Heroku. And a new browser tab appears, and your project is live and deployed.
Fantastic.
What's the database piece? I mean, I've looked at your project, but to describe to someone, right? Because someone's got SQLite locally. You can't use SQLite in Heroku because it's ephemeral. It'll be nuked every 24 hours or so. So how do you handle that part?
Let's take a step back, because we've been talking about how Heroku is good, but it's not everything. And so one of the things I like about this project is it's not Heroku specific. The goal is to take a simple Django project that works on your system and let you deploy it as simply as possible. And right now there's three steps, and I don't think you can get any shorter than that. So one of my tests for is this project worthwhile is, does it serve as a layer between our local projects and any platform? And so I looked for a second platform to support. And so I considered a number. I settled on Azure because I was looking for a platform where you can do the entire deployment process through the command line. Go ahead, Carlton.
Are you using App Service there, which is like the managed?
Yes.
Okay, so the Azure App Service. It's like the managed runtime. It's like the go on, Karen.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. I'm brand new to Azure, so this was my month of having 20 browser tabs open on my screen.
Yeah, okay. So
did you see Carlton's videos with Azure, like from a couple of years ago?
So is the app
service, I did not.
they're good. You should check them out. But Azure is, app service is like their Google App Engine or their Heroku, or it's their sort of managed application environment. Their equivalent of that.
Right. So before we get into details about a specific platform, I want to point out that for Django Simple Deploy, Azure support is experimental right now. But I wanted a proof of concept before digging into it further that this could work for multiple platforms. And so you can also do pip install Django Simple Deploy, add Simple Deploy to installed apps. And then an alternative deployment command is manage.py, Simple Deploy, I think it's --, platform Azure, and then automate all. And your project, it runs, modifies your project, and it pushes to Azure, and a new browser tab opens, and your project is live in Azure. And so that's the vision for this project, that if people have a simple project that works in their system, they can deploy it where they want to in three commands.
And then if you've got it working on Heroku and Azure, then it would easily work on App Engine, or I can't remember what Amazon's one is because they have too many services for me to remember the names of all of the services. But, you know, it would work anywhere, right? I mean, with the right backend.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things this leads to, I think we come back to this maybe near the end, is like, what's our wish list for existing platforms or new platforms? So if somebody out there like, I'm going to solve this problem and take that business away from those other providers. Heroku and Azure, you can do this entire process through the command line. There are some providers where you have to go to their site, click in, do a couple steps through their GUI, and then go back to your system. Every one of these platforms, you have to go to their site to make an account. But once you have an account to do the deployment, some require clicks and some can be done entirely through the command line.
Okay.
Tests. So you have a nice section on integration tests for the package. You know, there's a lot to say there, but, you know, tests are important. They're challenging to do in an automated universal.
Can I come back to that? Because I think what would be good is to focus on what this looks like for users for a moment, and then come back to the developer perspective. So who's this project aimed at? This is aimed at people who are brand new to programming, brand new to web development. They've finally gotten their project working locally and they want to push it live. It's aimed at people who may have more experience as a programmer but haven't delved into deployment. It's not meant as a replacement for projects like Cookie Cutter that are much more about configuring more complete, complex, production level project. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One of the goals for me is to provide something that is reliable and will be maintained. And so I can commit to maintaining this project, especially if it ends up in the next edition of Python Crash Course. I am motivated to, it's actually my maintenance work becomes easier because right now Heroku, Will knows this, Heroku is quite likely to change their process at some point because they have mothballed the project that they're relying on. It is getting more and more out of date and likely to break. And so once it fully breaks, they're going to have to change something. And so if I don't do Django Simple Deploy, then I'm going to need to rewrite half of a chapter in my book the moment Heroku decides to change their process. If I revise my book based on Django Simple Deploy, that acts as a layer between my book and Heroku's process. And I'm, you know, book-driven development, when we see a pain point as authors, it's an opportunity for a tool. If your tool only supports your readers, then that tool's going to go away as soon as your book is out of print. And also your readers are going to have to go find something else to solve that problem as soon as they're out of your book. So I am developing this for my own motivation, but also for general use. And so if this idea is good, I think book authors, tutorial authors, video authors, if the focus of your resource is not deployment, then this is a really good tool for just saying like, okay, here we've built this project. Here's three commands. You can throw it online and now we can focus on whatever aspect of the project we want to.
Carlton, would Button work with this? Can you command line?
Yeah, I mean, so the idea is I give you a list of environment variables that you need to, for the most basic setup, a list of environment variables that you need to, or settings that you need to populate from the environment. And that would, I need to look at the scripts, but the idea would be, I guess, that you edit the settings file to draw, because Heroku gives you your database URL, for instance, that you have to pull from the environment, right? So in principle, that would work in a similar kind of way. What I like about what Eric's talking about is that it's that literally that 1, 2, 3 in your existing Django environment. I think that's really sweet for that first deploy. I think that's a lovely pip install, add to installed apps. So you've got a management command and then just run it. That's lovely.
Yeah. A good example for how to think about this is one of you mentioned earlier, people working through the polls tutorial. And so they spend a week and they go through polls and it works in their system and like, cool, I'm going to deploy this. And then, oh, another week of learning. People who get to that point in their learning can run these three commands. And then their polls tutorial that was working on their system is now in the live browser tab. It doesn't mean you don't have to learn about deployment, because you do need to understand what changes were made if you're going to support that project on an ongoing basis and build on it. And so what this really does is people get to the point of being ready to learn about deployment, and now they have that week of learning. And that week of learning is filled with opportunities to make a mistake. Okay, for Heroku, you need to make a proc file. Okay, what if you make a typo in your proc file? All right, your project is not going to deploy. And we can look at Heroku output and say like, oh, there's where the mistake was. But most people, that Heroku output is a wall of text. And they have no idea where to start to look for that mistake. And so a little typo can mean days of kind of poking around, trying to figure out why your project is not working. And beyond just those hours or days of difficulty, that's that cliff. There are people, every one of those typos that happen, there's somebody who says like, oh, this is too hard, or I'm too busy, I can't figure this out, and they never come back to it. And so this kind of flips that learning process around. It says, run these three commands, now your project is live, and now you can go back and look at, okay, what are the changes that were made? If I'm going to do this again on a production level, what will I need to know? And I think that's a pretty compelling, to use a word, pedagogical approach.
Well, that's in a way what I, so my beginner's book, I wrote it in part because there was the Rails tutorial where the first chapter basically was like install, create something and deploy it. Boom. You don't know what's going on. It's all magic. But I wanted, to your point, something like that for Django. So in my books, like the first real project you do, which is pretty basic. I forget what it is. I think it's just a pages. It's just like a homepage and about page, but you deploy it. And it's, I even say like, you know, don't really worry about this. Like this is just the checklist, but I want you to get that feeling of something live that you can share with people, to your point, to get that aha moment and then try to iterate and add complexity. Because you do need that. And I was going to say to you, one thing I was impressed by reading both your books the first time and then the update is Learning Log is not a simple Django project. Like you go right into it. You've got user accounts, you've got static files, it's not, it could be simpler. I think it's great that it's not, but I think part of, you know, your other one is a statistical one and the Pygame one, those feel, there's more space to be descriptive, whereas the Django one, you cover a ton of information. So I think that's part of, you know, kudos to you for doing that, but if it was a simpler project, but I guess it's like, are you focusing on Django or are you focusing on the deployment? Because it would make deployment easier if you just had something simpler, but then you're not really learning about Django, which is, I know is the point of your book, is to say, here's a Python web framework you can do something interesting with.
Clarify what I mean by simple project. if you're using this default user accounts, the default auth packages in Django. I'm considering that fairly simple. If you're doing email...
Well, but users are confusing though, right? Like, I don't even put in users in the first two projects I cover. I think you need it. I think it's great to do, but you know, it's another thing. It's like, what's a user? What's a session? How do I log in? Even though you tell people that's a cliff, you know, for newbies.
I don't think my deployment work would be much easier if I had if I left users out, because
right.
the Heroku deployment steps are pretty prescriptive regardless of what your project looks like. Proc file maybe is simpler if you don't have static files, but projects don't look very good without any static files.
Well, and that the collect static thing on Heroku, that's something that trips things up a lot, that it automatically, unless you turn it off, runs collect static. That leads to a lot of beginner errors.
Yes. Yes. Again, that's another good point where the whole point of this is everything is done correctly for you, and then you get to go back and look at it.
Carlton, you were going to say something.
No, I was just, you know, I'm just thinking like, you know, the standard, that kind of standard setup that, you know, use for the simplest deployment, configure the virtual env, you know, migrate the DB, collect static, run the Whiskey server. That's kind of it, right? But to wrap that up nicely is the challenge. And, you know, yeah, anyway, I haven't got anything particularly interesting to say. I'm just thinking hard.
So you mentioned the third edition of your book. Is there anything else you can tease that you're going to change or update?
No.
Other than deployment?
No, I'm not sure when the third edition will come out. Everything in the second edition is up to date. And so we try to, as you're well familiar with, try to maximize the lifespan of each edition. But as soon as the new edition comes out, I start a note file about what I might need to change or want to change. And so like I played with the Heroku build pack last year. I'm trying this approach now. I think this is going to work. I think this is a really good project. And I think I'm going to use it. And I think we're going to see some people use it for tutorials. If you guys want to talk, I kind of think of this conversation as motivation. You know, what's our all collective experience with deployment? Why have we grown? What does this look like for?
It's because we're old. Learners? It's because we're old, Eric. Doesn't matter what
I don't
it
know.
Is.
No, I've heard the young people groan about it too. My groan is the same now as it was 15 years ago. And we talked about what it's like for learners. And I think that the third aspect of this is, okay, implementation. Is there anything you are curious about what this looks like under the hood? Because to users, this is really those three commands. Install it, add it to installed apps, run it. And then their project is online. And my next piece of work is to clean up the output and consider the artifacts that are left behind. And I think what I'll probably do is dump some text files, maybe markdown files, into a folder in the project. So, you know, this runs in the terminal. You get a whole bunch of information about your deployment. And then once you close your terminal, that information is gone. And you can run something like Heroku Apps Info and see what the current state of your project. But I think I want to create a folder in the project, like deployment notes, and it just summarizes what was done, summarizes how to make your next change, and then maybe links to resources. Because, you know, I don't want to pretend that this is a replacement for learning about deployment. It just does that initial deployment, and then you need to move on and understand the deployment and how to work with it. So leave enough behind that people can know where to go to learn more and use it. Because it's also like, okay, we just changed your project. And so that's an interesting step too.
I mean, I just wonder from, you talked about it being a pedagogical approach. I wonder, would you advise people to do something like a git commit before they run it, and then so that they've got a nice Git diff that shows them exactly what the changes were, that kind of, you know.
It's a great question. So there's actually two ways to use a command. So the three-step version is the simplest. If you run it without the automate all flag, then it configures your project and it leaves it for you to push the project. So the two assumptions about this project are one, that you have specified your requirements, either using requirements.txt, pipenv, or poetry, and then that you are using Git to track your project. So if you run simple deploy, manage.py simple deploy without the automate all flag, then it just configures your project so that it's ready to push to Heroku. Builds your proc file, there's a static file settings, sets a config variable for debug to be false in the production version, generates a new secret key. And so, yeah, after that, you can look at your project and then do the git push command. I did, one of my challenges with this was to answer that question, what's the minimum number of commands? And so that automate all, going back to the idea of like, what people want is an opinionated approach to all those deployment questions. Should debug be false? Or can I leave it true in my first deployment? Okay, I decided for this project, I'll make it false by default, and then show you how you can make it true. Because, you know, those of us who have experience with production apps, the idea of debug being true in production is, oh gosh, why would you even consider that? But for your very first deployment where you're just understanding the process, being able to say like, okay, it works on my screen, my local system is not working, all I get is this blank error page. If you can turn debug true on for a moment and just see, oh, okay, that's what Heroku sees, you can fix that. And I think there's room to let people do that and not give them the impression that that's okay to do sometimes in production. But the opinion is, set a false initially, give them a good starting point, and go from there.
It has to be at least safe by default, right? Because for every person who's in that learning position where, you know, perhaps turning on debug true just to see the error output, you know, might be a safe thing to do because it's a learning project. There's be someone else who's literally deploying their business using just the basic three commands and not really thinking about it at all. And whilst it's incumbent upon them to think about it, kind of, we know that they won't. So making it safe by default is a good idea.
One thing that resonates with me is what we're talking about here, which is the next step for readers or consumers of your open source project or your book. I feel like the weakest part of my books is, of course, I would say this because I wrote them, so I think they're okay, but I think the weakest part is where I direct people next. I spend a lot of time trying to think about not just saying, oh, see you later, you know, here's a couple of websites. Like, is there something pedagogical? Is there something more I can do to guide people? Because it's easy to say, well, you'd go learn about deployment online or, short of making that resource myself, how do I like make a roadmap or a curriculum for people? I'm sure you've thought about this too. So that's a way to tee up deployment. If you were going to create or write a book on deployment or curriculum, what would you say someone should do? Like, how do you go about that? Because I don't know of a place that goes step by step in a progressive manner through all that.
Boy, that is hard. One of the kinds of emails I got most consistently after Python Crash Course started to become popular is what next? So people would write and say, thank you for this book. It really helped me get through the initial learning. What now? I'd give some quick thoughts, but I ended up writing in the online resources for the book a section called recommended reading. And it's really,
yeah,
like
that's a really
four
nice,
or five,
yeah.
Yeah, it's really four or five pages of, okay, you got through the base of the pyramid or the trunk of the tree, and now there's all kinds of directions you can go. And so where do you go with your general Python learning? Where do you go with Django? Where do you go with all the surroundings of things like Bash and databases and all that? So I don't think there's a simple, quick answer. I think you have to either have a one-on-one conversation with people and sort out where they need to go, or provide a kind of map of where you can go.
Interesting. Interesting.
And I think it's hard to do that in a book. I think that's a, you can provide that online, but it's really hard in a book to say, here's all the directions you can go.
Taking your point.
And
For
deployment specifically, I don't know that there ever will be a book because it changes so much and there's so many options. And so at some point, like Carlton said, okay, some people are going to use a project like this for their business. And okay, if you want to start proof of concept with something like Django Simple Deploy, you can try that. But if you're building out business critical infrastructure on, say, Django, you have to dig into deployment. And so you have to choose a platform, and then you do need to spend time digging into that platform's documentation, or, you know, consult or pay somebody who knows it better already. And those are conversations that sometimes people need rather than just, here's the resource. Sometimes it's what they really need is like, okay, how do you think about building a business on top of what you just learned?
Taking the phrase you used, Will, about go learn about deployment online, one of the motivations for getting started with Button was that actually if people go and start trying to type about deployment online, was that they get taken into this sort of tiger pit of macho deployment, you know, one-upmanship, where it's like, well, you know, we're using this. And sure, for the big companies and serious engineers, that's important stuff. You talk about deployment cliff. I always think of it as the deployment gap. There's the beginners over here and then a massive gap to the infrastructure engineers all the way over there. And
yes,
if you try and learn online, it's all it is infrastructure engineer stuff. And you can't, it's really hard to find deployment, you know, for your 95% of projects who don't have a 10,000 concurrent request problem. They've got a 10 concurrent request program, you know. I just need it to serve a few requests. I just need to get my app online. That's really difficult to find resources for, especially if you just start Googling.
I think that's right, that if someone's taking the time to write something, it's generally an advanced person who's proud of something they figured out, but it doesn't apply to the 95%. I've often wondered, is there a way to mimic the load of a high performance site without all the costs, you know, involved, right? So we say to people, well, like, is there a way to teach someone, say, okay, I'm going to make a sandbox and I'm going to mock getting slammed with all these requests, you know, either one at a time or all at once. Or that's the same thing. I mean, you know, like once a day versus like continuous heavy load, and then have someone go through the steps to fix that. Is there a way to do that absent doing it live in a big company? There's probably some way to fake that, but
Locust.io is a very good tool. So you can define a set of requests that will come. Yeah, and you can say, I want, you know, 30 requests from 100, you know, I want so many requests per second from so many clients, and I want them to scale up rate. And what's really nice is it's really difficult to interpret. You know, you have to go slowly and interpret the results, you know, intelligently, and that takes time and looking at it. But you can kind of see where your response time starts to flatten off. And you're like, right, that's actually, you know, if it starts, you know, you get to 10 and it's going up nicely and you're like, brilliant. And then 15 requests, it starts to tear. And then 30 requests, it's like, oh no, it's basically flatlined. It's like, okay, that's my limit. That's as many as I can hit. And if Hacker News hits me and I get more than that, you know, my site's not really going to perform. So it's a really good tool. And it's, you know, you use Python, you write little Python scripts to generate this traffic. So
yeah, 18,000 stars. And I just learned about it. So yeah.
What was it called again?
It's called Locust.io.
Locust.io.
Locust like the insect?
Yeah, yeah. Because it's like a plague of requests that come down eat your website. But it's a very useful tool for, you know, you want to compare different setups and, oh, you know, how many Gunicorn worker processes should I use? Well, okay, you can spin up the box and you can try hitting it. You know, do I need 8? If I hit 8, how many requests can I hit? If I have 4 workers, how many requests can I hit? If I use pre-forked versus threaded, you know, these options which are in the Gunicorn config option, but like, what difference do they make? Well, with Locust, it's very easy to sort of spin one up, send some traffic against it with a particular profile and say, okay, interestingly, the pre-fork with 4 workers for this size unit is the best option.
I would pay for a Django Locus book.
Again, I think that's a great tutorial. Maybe a great like small online course, but it'd be hard to write a book on that. And I say write a book on it and maintain it.
We're coming up a little bit on time. I know we haven't dived into this, but I have to kind of ask Eric, like the future of teaching tech. Like I think sometimes deep thoughts about, you and I have made it work to different degrees, but most people, it just doesn't pay to teach technology. And yet everyone wants to learn this stuff to get jobs. And I wonder if your thinking has changed just in the last 2 years around, is there a solution there? Because when I look at it, I see it's hard to do anything as to consumers, directly to consumers, because they don't have money out of pocket. It's hard to do something without an accreditation where they get a degree and then, you know, they get a cyber degree and then they can go check the box on a job. So the need is growing, and yet the pathway to like do it yourself, you have to be very entrepreneurial. I mean, you wrote the book, but you also have the website, you have these projects, you've been doing it for a long time. Like there isn't a straight path where someone who knows this stuff, who wants to teach, can make close to what they would make day jobbing versus writing a book, and then they have to update it. So I throw that to you as, you know, the need is there, but the pieces to make it happen still seem to be missing to me.
Boy, cue up the big question.
Well, as a former teacher too.
right.
Or as a current different classroom teacher.
Yeah. The Orange site had an article yesterday about how we teach code is broken or something like that. I think of Carlton when big things come up, like, oh gosh, okay, all the things we should think about for this. So I think it's important when you're thinking of the question that Will just posed, to look at the history of learning resources for programming. So if you go back to, say, the 50s or so, when people were first building these big physical computers, electronic computers, there was barely any documentation. I mean, I don't know if people these days know this, but it used to be like your company or institution would order a giant room-filling computer. That company would then like come with trucks and install it into your institution, and you would pay people to come and like facilitate your first use of that machine. And then things got smaller and people wrote documentation, so that now you can just ship a computer and ship a manual and leave it to your users to learn that. And then people started writing books. And those books were written by programmers for other programmers with no real notion of non-programmers reading them. So they're very dry and very technical, and I should say very dry. Some of them had some attempts at humor. And then programmers started writing for the general audience, but they're still fairly dry and fairly non-friendly, I should say, non-pedagogical. They were not written with a critical mindset of what might go wrong and what can people do when something goes wrong. And then you started to have a mix of people with a programming background and more general backgrounds. And so you started to see better programming books where the technical foundation was still strong, but there was more thinking about, okay, what might it be like for a non-programmer to work through this? And in the past 10 years or so, I feel like there's been more coming out from people who have a pedagogical background, have experience thinking and working with people who are learning, and focusing on, okay, we need a solid technical foundation for this resource, and we need clear, critical, intentional thinking about how people learn, what they already know, what they're learning in this resource, and then where they're going to go next. And it's about connecting that path. So my takeaway from that article yesterday is like, how we teach code isn't broken. It's just that there's no one way to do it. And so there are some bad ways. There's some really good ways. And the long-term thing that we're all aiming for is a wide variety of really good learning approaches and learning resources that are well-maintained and whatnot. Your question, Will, of how do you make money offering those resources and services? That's another question.
I think of this because the startup I was at is a Quizlet is an education startup, which hopefully for me will go public this year. But that's a rare case of something actually working out in the edtech space. There's this huge cliff. Like I saw Codecademy just got sold. They were founded around the same time. Treehouse just imploded. You know, there's, I wonder if there's any middle ground between free code camp, which is fantastic, and a structured curriculum that isn't paid by an employer or isn't doing all sorts of dark tricks to up, you know, crank the knob on getting people to pay for something and not having a good outcome. It seems like there are people who, you know this information and would like to teach it, but there isn't an easy way to just do it.
It's a hard problem. And I think people need to approach the problem of how do you create a learning resource that's going to be received well and used. I think you need to think as critically and intentionally about that as you would building an engineering project. It's a classic, like, people disappear into their computers for a year, build something, and then come out with a working product and be like, oh, how do I tell people about this? How do I gain users? And so it's the same thing with resources. I think money is important to talk about with that, because a lot of these projects that have failed or even caused harm, their priority is making money. And money and education are an interesting pair.
Well, the problem is success means people leave you faster. Like, you can't have a subscription education business, because if you succeed, they leave. And even if you don't succeed, they're going to leave. You know, so Quizlet, right, loses a quarter of its users, or, you know, less than that. But, you know, if you think of a high school product, right, like, you're losing a quarter every year. It's it's a not a great business. Anyways, it's one of those.
So you have to think about that. And so what that means is, okay, if you're successful, your users leave, but then they should be telling other people how they learned. And so,
and there should be a fresh cohort every year, no?
Right. And so high schools get that because people just show up. And so for a learning resource, your hope is that people will use your project, be successful, leave, and then tell other people about it. I will say something about pricing. You know, I see beginner-friendly pricing. I mean, books are still popular because people can afford them, largely. The value that people get out of my books or Will's books are just fantastic.
And your book is so, you know, is what, 500 pages? I mean, it's, off the charts, the value.
$25 and they get life-changing experience. But I also see people charging $250 for independently produced materials. And so there's
videos.
There's a never place text. For that. There's a place for that in niche markets where you never can have a large audience, a large number of buyers. And there's a place for that in corporate. But when people are aiming materials that are aimed at individuals and pricing it at multiple $100s, that's an interesting decision. And so I think that if you're going into educational materials, you need to think through all those and come up with an answer that makes sense for yourself, for your learners, and for the market and the world.
Yeah. Well, edX just got sold too, which makes me sad. And it reminds me that back in my younger years in 2010, I had a chance to meet the founders of both Segment and Stripe multiple times. And both of them started off with education products and then pivoted to respectively the $3 billion acquisition and probably $100 billion IPO. So, you know, the desire was there, but the business model, you know, that can't be the reason why you do it. Anyways,
there's nothing to say after that. You know, it's a perfect end.
Yeah. So we will have links to all the things mentioned. Django Simple Deploy is on GitHub. Try it out. Use it. I think people know about Eric's book, flashcards, all the rest. Thank you for taking
the time. Can I make one request?
Time.
Yeah, please do.
Please.
Of listeners? Yeah, so I don't have anything to promote beyond what Will is mentioning, but for Django Simple Deploy, it's on GitHub. And if you if you're interested in this project, if you have a simple project of your own and want to just try it, I'd love to know if it works. If you are creating learning resources for Django and the idea of being able to let your users deploy the project quickly, please give it a try. And if you have any feedback on how this could be useful to you as a creator of learning resources, I'd love to know that, because I'm creating it for my own needs, but it will do well if it serves many people's needs. So if you have any interest in this project, please do reach out.
I'm going to do that myself once I finish my the last two of my book updates. But that's something I want to do, as well as button.dev whenever that's ready. I promise, Carlton, when it's live, I will do a tutorial for
him. I just need about 3 weeks of normality and then we're there. So,
all right. Well, again, thank you, Eric. We are DjangoChat.com, ChatDjango on Twitter, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.